Okay, well, I'm going to try to cover some of the recent magnetic scattering from YBCO superconductors. This is a subject that's been in play now for many years, but still seems to defy really any kind of explanation on what the real substance of it is. Nevertheless, we made quite a bit of progress, I think, particularly using the splicing sources, the pulse sources, in the last couple of years. So let me talk about that. I have a lot of collaborators, but I think just for this work, Victor Ongjiwu, Pengxing Dai has been a good collaborator on the ISIS material. Pengxing Dai has been involved for many years in me working on these excitations and these materials and other materials, and certainly we've put out a lot of stuff together over a long time. Stephen Hayden has been very instrumental in helping us with the experiments at ISIS. And Fatigue Dugan has grown all our crystals. Without those, of course, we wouldn't be in business at all. So he's of great importance to us. Well, we've taken data in a little different way, and Takeshi Gagami spoke about that a little bit this morning. Quite often in the old days, we used to do things with triple axis spectrometers, and certainly do in many cases. But now, for lots of times doing magnetic excitations, particularly at high energies, it's much more productive to use a pulse beam, and then this pulse beam lets you have all of this. Let's see, how's this work? Have all of this area covered by multi-detectors, so we can look at a lot of phase space at once, if you like. And this is a cut at 33 millivolts through this phase space on YPO 6.6 at some low temperature below the superconducting temperature. And we see here that at 0.5K and at minus 0.5H or 0.5H, we see this blob. And we see this blob here in these other equivalent positions. And this is the well-known resonance that you see in these materials. And the resonance then is at this point here. This is this peak that occurs below TC in these YBCO materials, and actually dominates the scattering, as you see, at low temperatures. And in fact, you can even see the second order peak from that down here. See, there's a peak 0.5 and down here 1.5. That's the second order peak. And so there's a lot of information in this. And then when you can add all this information up together, it gives you a good signal to noise. So these spallation sources are very powerful for this type of measurement. And in fact, the new SNS, of course, is going to be fantastically powerful once this comes along.
What are those lines?
Pardon? These lines, these are detector banks, and these are the bank edges. So there are a few places not covered by detectors. But other than that, we certainly cover most of the area there with detectors.
Do you see the beginnings of the higher harmonics of this thing? If you go like, yes, exactly.
Yeah,
right. Yes, you do?
Well, yeah, there's a higher harmonic there. Yeah. See, that's 0.5, 1.5. That was the form factor goes down. That proves it's magnetic right away. If it was a phono, it would go up. So if we have the underdope material, this shows the kind of introduction of what you might expect for the scattering here. This is not superconducting, but it's an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. And this is just room temperature. You can see, you find the main mode, which is just the acoustic mode. And because we have bilayers here, coupled bilayers, there are two types of modes, acoustic modes and optical modes. The acoustic mode goes down like this in a rather normal way. You can see as you go out in scattering H bar omega is 175, the scattering kind of goes out this way as you raise the energy up to 275, which is up near the zone boundary. The other mode, the optical mode, you can see here, that's this mode here, and we don't have too many measurements on that. But that mode has a gap. This gap here is about 60 millivolts, and then the scattering goes on up from that 60 millivolts up in this manner here. So that's what we expect for the insulator. And we're going to show then how the superconductor changes all of this pattern. But we're still going to find that we have optic and acoustic modes. It's just they're quite different in the way they appear.
That 60 millivolts is not the J-curve, is it? It's related to J-curve, right?
Which? Mid 60.
The 60 millivolt gap between the symmetric and anti-symmetric.
Yeah, that's related to what?
But it's not directly J-perm.
No,
I can't remember. Let's see.
There's a relationship.
There's a relationship, but I can't remember quite what it is. Right. This is what one sees. Then another picture of the resonance at low energy. This is a pattern of YBCO 6.6 down at 16K, and we just show here as a function of temperature. This remains then, even above TC to some degree, finally vanishes up around room temperature. So the resonance itself is not at underdoped material. 6.6 is still around, even above the superconvection transition, but we'll see. Shortly, as you go to higher doping, this resonance disappears rather rapidly at TC. And we can see here, this is KX plus K plus H. This is K and H. The resonance is rather round in Q space, K space.
So it's not tied to TC?
Not tied to TC, not in the underdoped materials, no. Extends well above TC, we should see.
What's the difference between the left-hand corner and the bottom right?
Here?
At
216K. Well, that's 300K.
No, 16K.
Oh, one is 216K.
So three
that
one is QX versus QY.
Yeah, one is, this is QX.
Q versus energy.
This is just K and this is H here. The other is energy, I'm sorry. So this scale here is MeV over here. You really should have MeV over here too, because that's MeV a little left. Yes. So
we've been called coached by not by your group, but by others, that there is a magic connection between resonance peak and TC and superconductivity.
At high doping, here's more optimally doped. You see, here's YBCO 6.93, and there's the resonance again. And in this shape, it has this kind of downward curvature here, which is this part here, which is incommensurate, but that goes away then at TC. Here in the optimally doped material, but not in the underdoped material. That goes from by 300, all the scattering is all gone. There's really not much left of it here at 100K either. But this little part down below here, that part where the arrow is this place where incommensurate scattering is found below the resonance. And here's just a scan through that at 34 millivolts, which is through there. So this is a resonance, and then below this resonance is incommensurate scattering. This is all we knew for a long time, but then fairly recently, we made a greatly expanded view of the scattering in YBCO 6.6. And this then shows a picture clear up to, let's see, the last energy here is 100, and it's hard for me to read it, 105 millivolts. I guess at this point, but we have some scans then we've taken through these patterns here, which are just patterns again on the ISIS multi-detector. And one sees rather clearly below the resonance, we see these four spots again in this pattern here with the line up this direction and the four spots being in this direction and this direction. And these are definitely spots. This is not a ring. This is going to come up a little bit later in the talk, but these are certainly spots. And there's no evidence for a ring at that point with scattering. The resonance is here. We've taken a cut through it in this direction, and that's shown here. Cut through this is shown here at 24 millivolts. That's the incommensurate scattering below the resonance. Then we have scattering that starts to look, I'll pick this one out, this direction. Of course, it's a little bit blobby and much harder to see. It's spread out. And of course, the scattering all everywhere is weak. And this scattering is mediumly weak. But nevertheless, if you take a cut through it, you can certainly see the incommensurate scattering here. And this one, say, at 85 millivolts. And we notice that pattern there is certainly rotated from that pattern. So we see the up-downness of that pattern is a peak right on top. Well, there is no peak on top here, but peaks over there, 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 and there. So rather amazingly, this scattering is rotated 45 degrees as it goes through the resonance, and then on up as far as we can measure it, up to 105 millivolts. It's still incommensurate, but rotated by 45 degrees. And so the question in our mind now is, what's going on here? What kind of theories can then, or models then, can explain this behavior?
permit or an insulator and you went up to the higher energies, would it be a ring?
An insulator would be a ring, yeah, right.
Well, an insulator would be a ring, how do you know?
Of a scattering. I mean, if I have just an anti-ferro magnetic peak, then I just come up like this, right?
Oh, just came with, yeah. So what's going on?
So, here's the exact question, the answer.
We know what's going on, right?
Yeah. So here's the exact answer to your question. Here at 60 millivolts, here's what a spin wave would look like, a ring, of course, right? If I take a cut at a given energy, here's what we actually get. We get this four peak pattern. So these are not spin waves in any sense of the word. That's what a spin wave looks like. This is what we get, this pattern, this four-fold pattern, which is something certainly altogether very different.
Is the lower panel is a data or a simulation?
That's just a simulation of just four peaks of the pattern, of a fit to the data that we have.
And what, a simulation of what? You put by hand four peaks?
Right. Yeah.
So
well,
it's a simulation.
It's a fit.
Manual. It's four peak covered with the resolution.
Yeah.
It's fine. But basically, we don't know what's going on, right?
Well, that's just... what would we get if we had four peaks convolved with the data, or the resolution of the instrument?
I was trying to tell you, you know, what energy is meant to be.
60 millivolts.
So, a question. Was that seen in the underdope, and is that?
No, the underdope, this is something like this.
This is seen in the insulator?
Yeah.
No, not this.
Yeah.
I mean the experiment, the previous slide.
No.
What's
this? This is 6.6, yeah. Yeah, this is underdope still. So, a lot of the scattering, as we've seen, then, is above the resonance. In fact, that's a very important part of the data. As it turns out, we've been talking for many years about the resonance have something to do directly with superconductivity. But in fact, if we add up the total magnetic scattering for the region between 60 millivolts and 120 millivolts, we get a scattering that's twice as big as the resonance and the sub-resonance itself put together. So, in fact, the resonance may look like it has a lot of scattering, and it does at low energies, but it's dwarfed by a total scattering, even this area, and of course, the scattering goes up beyond this value here. So, if one thinks about somehow magnetism driving superconductivity, I think we have to remember that most of the magnetism is up in here somewhere.
And how far up does it go beyond 120?
Yeah, well, we really can't tell in 6.6, it goes out of our range at about 120 millivolts, 110 millivolts, but it's still going up. Okay, so I don't know what the zone boundary is. So here's a general idea that we have in the scattering. We have two bilayers here connected by some J. And that therefore gives us two channels, the optical channel where J is above zero, bigger than zero. And this is the J disconnects the two bilayers. This is the J one gets when J, this is the optical channel where J is smaller than zero. And that gets us some sort of bilayer form factor, if you like. And so there's an out-of-phase form factor between the acoustic mode and optic mode, unless you can distinguish them just by going to a different place in Q space, so you can pick out the optic and acoustic mode. So far, what we've seen is a pattern that tends to look like this on the acoustic mode. We've seen a pattern that's incommensurate below the resonance, comes together after resonance, then becomes incommensurate again above the resonance, but rotates by 45 degrees. So we see a pattern here then that just tells you here, kind of as a diagram, that E smaller than E resonance, we have this kind of square. At the resonance, we have a point, and above the resonance, we have this kind of square again. I'm going to come back to this in just a minute. This is the optical mode, and we measured this somewhat carefully for YBCO 6.93, the optimally doped material. We'll find out that, in fact, looks like this.
So what happened above? Nothing?
The optical mode? We have Yeah, well, I'm showing the optical mode measurements, which we have in just a minute, for 6.93. These are just some temperature-dependent modes of measurements, just to show you that this material and the 6.6 material, certainly the scattering gets certainly smeared out on up. This is energy of 85 millivolts, and so as we go on up to 300 millivolts, there is still some scattering there, but it's kind of smudged out. And here are some kind of scans to it. And as you go up to from 10 to 66 to 300 millivolts, the scattering kind of peaks up finally in the middle and sort of is not incommensurate anymore. Certainly at TC, the commensurability is still there, but goes away at 300K. Here's just the resonance, as you see it again, temperature between 10, 66, and 300K. Well, here's some measurements we made very recently at ISIS again, and this data is much more difficult to take. It's a higher doping level, 6.93, which is optimally doped. The signal is pretty ratty, but we can still get something out of it. In fact, this is a rather long counting period, about 2 weeks on this one set of patterns here and one more set. So this is about as good as you can do until the SNS or something like this comes along. So the data is not quite as good as we'd like, but still gives an indication of what's going on. We have below the resonance here, 32.5, we have this pattern of points of little dots here, which are the square, which we saw below the resonance before. This is an HH, not H. The other was labeled H, so this square is the same orientation as we had before. And here it shows we have incommensurability below the resonance. At the resonance, this is a famous 41 MeV resonance now that we have in the optimal material, and it has one peak. And again, we see the peaks rotating and spreading out again here above the resonance, and we see the data again is not as good as we'd like, but again, at least up to 60 millivolts, which is as far as we've gone here, or can go at the moment, we see this incommensurability. And this data here is 15K minus 100K, just to kind of get the phonons out of the picture, because the scattering is so small, we really have to take this difference to get a clean picture of the magnetic scattering. So we've done that in this case.
Excuse me, there are no data at higher energies, or is it just too noisy?
Yeah, well, we barely see anything there, if we do see anything. And so it is getting smaller by a long shot. So the data at the same time is getting a lot smaller as we go up here. If it's a metal, this is a metal, of course, probably running into a continuum of states, you know, of some sort of the equivalent of a stoner modes in a metal. So the scattering is certainly getting smaller, and they're just running out of signal as well.
The four peaks, say, at low energies,
yes,
which eventually then rotates, in the fewest type bloom zone, can you indicate whether they are along the diagonal or whether they're, I mean, can you sketch it?
They're along pi. I mean, they're along pi zero.
One's below the resonance.
One below the resonance.
One below the resonance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Then they rotate to 45 degrees above the resonance.
Okay.
Just one more question. When you go to energies below the 32, is there anything seen? I mean, how far down can you...
No, then the gap opens up, of course. And so we also have a lot of problems with phonons down here, but below about 32 millivolts, the 30, then this disappears as well. But this disappears here because of the gap.
So the
gap size is around 30 millivolts.
You going to show the optical one?
Yep, this is it. This is the optical mode. Again, low temperature minus high temperature. Again, the data is not as clean as we can get, but you know, it's the best you can do with the technology we have available. At low energies, we don't see anything. I mean, the optical mode has a gap, of course. Above that, at 41 millivolts, we begin to see an incommensurability, actually, below the optical, sort of the optical resonance, or the beginning and bottom of the optical mode, if you like, and then nothing above that. So this is rather different than what we've seen before. Up to 61 millivolts, Well, we could clearly see scattering before. In the acoustic channel, we see nothing in the optical channel. So we see scattering at the top end, it's 53 millivolts, and then disperses downward. And there's incommensurate, if you like. We see these incommensurate scattering, and then finally disappears altogether at low energies as well. So if I back up here a little bit, see if I can see if I have that. So that's this pattern here. So for the optical resonance, we see this pattern here, the top of it's 53 millivolts, and then there's nothing above that, rather oddly, but we see this downward dispersion from it, and then it disappears on that side as well. So this looks like this sort of, in summary, and this sort of a drawing model, at 53 millivolts, we see this point, which is some sort of optical resonance, if you like. Below this optical resonance, we see this square again, and then finally below that, we don't see anything again. So the optical resonance is kind of interesting. It has behavior similar to this in some respects, but it's kind of odd to see nothing on the high energy side of it.
So just to be completely sure, the four peaks are rotated in the optical one like they are at the high energy.
Yeah, yes.
So at some point, are you going to say something about doping dependence and commensuration? Like
your paper, no, I mean, those are the only two that we've done at any. So 6.6 and 6.93 are the only two materials that have been done in any detail of the high energy scattering. So.
Well, in your group.
In our group.
Yeah, but there is a contradiction between what you say and John
Francois
will say about the doping dependence.
No, not at all. I don't think so.
For YBCO, it saturates around 0.1.
Yeah, yeah.
But John's, there's no contradiction. John's interpretation was that because the fact that it disperses downwards and then the spin gap gets cut off.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
you're still seeing it.
Yeah, there's no way to know, right? Because you have the spin gap and you can't prevent it.
No, but basically the incommensuration stays flat after 0.1, right?
Yeah, that's still true.
Yeah.
For the acoustic mode below the resonance.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think there's no contradiction between John and ourselves, certainly. Okay. Let's sort of just show. This is just some temperature independent data. This is this measurement. See. This is this point. Let's see. I guess it's. This one here, I guess, to show as a function of temperature. And again, well, this is a function. Let's see, this is.
But that's the optical mode.
That's the optical mode, yes. And that's a function of. Let's see.
You need to go one more slide.
Yeah, almost
like, yeah, that's the one I had before. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's. So this is.
That's the acoustic mode,
I guess. Yeah, that's the acoustic mode, and this shows that goes away as you raise the temperature up from 100 to 290. And I guess this was the optic mode here at the point here below the optic mode.
So could you go back one second?
Yeah, it's this point here, as I remember, the temperature dependence of that.
Yeah. So
and that is shown in this graph over here, just to show that the optical mode kind of goes away with temperature, as you might expect as well, and fuzzes out to nothing.
So, would you say that we still have a density at 290 or not?
Well, very little. I mean, anything we might see is pretty well smudged out, I would say.
So what is TC for this one, 90-something?
That's TC for that is 91.5 or something like that. That's very near optimally doped.
So if I go to 150 over there, what is there something that I'm just pushing the issue about whether intensity dies off right at TC or?
No, it's only done. There's, you know, 100 degrees, or maybe it's questionable. You know, there may be something at 100, but it's not much. Certainly, most of it dies off at TC in the optimally doped material. But there's still some left.
I would like to take an issue a little bit here because there's clearly quite a bit in the background.
Well, the 30 Kelvin around there also
from
it's very touching.
Yeah.
It's completely polarized.
Well, it's not I think it's hard to say. know, I don't want to come out as a strong advocate either, but that's something there or not something there, you know, that's, I would say we don't have a lot of evidence that there's too much scattering above TC.
But what the contrast of these bright and dark regions, and the contrast is about 2 or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so there is fine, there's contrast not 2, but it's 1 or something.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Quite substantial contrast. And you're sitting already above TC.
Here, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, what do you say? I say that there's very little evidence for much, about much scattering above 100.
Yeah. I'd say that linear cuts would help in terms of seeing. Yeah. So, okay.
Well, I mean, various
people responded to the
weight of the function of the temperature. Yes. And it's much more convincing, I think, the
point when you do it that way. Because you see that there's a dramatic drop, and then... Oh, you're talking about drop TC, but it's kind of noisy. I haven't followed this closely, and the reason it dies off to zero is that actually, like, Bohr is at intensity, but by he extracts the value at exactly TC. So by construct, this thing will start from zero at TC. If you look carefully at the error bars, it dips down negative there.
Who are you talking about?
Philip Bohr.
Philip Bohr.
Oh, okay. Right. So this is the one with the magic, so like saying, right at TC, it rises up as a T minus TC square at min zero TC. So if you, by definition, is subtracted at TC.
Yeah. All right, well. Yes.
What was the magnetization, just like you had done the separation between the resonance and the region outside resonance?
The scattering above and below? Yeah, I haven't got that number right now. I mean, we can put this in absolute units, and we'll put this in absolute units eventually,
yes,
but I haven't done this yet.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, there have been a couple of ways to think about this. There's been a theory came out on which the Fermi surface is sort of based, or at least the basis for this experiment, this theory by this group of people. And this is a model of what the magnetic excitations would look like in a dx squared minus y squared superconductor based on a Fermi surface. The Fermi surface, I think, was taken to be something like BISCO because we don't know the Fermi surface of YBCO. Say, pardon?
That came from up there, not anywhere.
Okay. So, and this is this acoustic mode, if you like, and it does sort of show this resonance being here where this arrow is, and then this incommensurate scattering down here, and this little scattering here, which is not nearly as big as it should be, also shows up in this RPA calculation. So these people can consider their experiment, their measurement, or rather their calculation, at least somewhat successful in explaining the data. And it's based on just the Fermi surface model, where you have this scattering here, this resonance and this below the resonance coming from this, I guess, the scattering inside the Fermi surface. I'm not going to say too much about this. And this scattering up here coming from Unklop scattering between Fermi surfaces, different Fermi surfaces. And it produces something that does at least look like the data in the sense that you have scattering here, and then you have this scattering again that's incommensurate up here. It doesn't look like the data because this is very small here over this region, over this small region. And in fact, we've seen the scattering, oops, my pointers. We've seen the scattering extend over a rather large region up above this, the resonance here, and this is only a small region here. And it's also not very intense. In fact, we saw the total intensity up here is actually considerably more the intensity down there, but at least It is a calculation based on the Fermi surface. It does give some semblance of reality. Well, just I want to point out too that in this material here, the 214 material, measurements have also been made that kind of look like this maybe resonance up here at this 40 millivolts and this lower part are coming together so that there is becoming at least some universality in what one thinks the excitations may be, in some sense that there is this incommensurability below the, some sort of coming together, this coming together perhaps of resonance in 214, if you want to call it that, and then there aren't any measurements really that exist above that.
Certainly, they are now. I mean,
yeah.
So there is nothing up above this 40 millimoles?
No, it turns over as well. They've done the experiment now on ISIS.
I'm sorry, you said it rotates?
It rotates. It has not been published.
Okay, well, this is, we talked about John Francotta's measurement, I guess, or somebody brought that out. So there certainly is a model in terms of a thermal surface, if you like, that gives some sort of reasonable fit to the data. But then there's this experiment by John Francotta on a material which is really stripe phased. This is a material that really does have stripes in it, as we know, very low TC, barely superconducting at all, but has this exact same pattern that we found. This is in units one to units of H in the orientation of the reciprocal lattice one usually uses in 2-1-4. But if one uses that orientation for the reciprocal lattice, which is 45 degrees rotated from ours, one finds the same sort of pattern, this pattern of 4 points below this coming together, which we have here, which we might call a resonance or something like a resonance, because at least the scattering comes together in this 4 points. And then this is not so clear here. These measurements are difficult as well, but certainly that is, these edges certainly are 45 degrees from these edges here. So we have a material here which is quite different than our material. It's 2-1-4. Of course, but it's the stripe phase material. So is our material more stripe phase like, you can ask, particularly below the resonance, because we do have a material which is more stripes, which does have real stripes and looks identical to ours. Or is the Fermi surface a better way to look at it? And I don't have the answer to that, because we don't really have, I think, a conclusive way to really model the scattering at least that I can say, because no matter how you can look at it several different ways and get several different pictures that look somewhat the same, whether you have stripes or a Fermi surface. So,
does the RPA rotate?
The RPA does rotate.
Yeah.
Because the scattering rotates between the main scattering and the umklopf scattering, rotate gives you that 45 degree rotation.
I've forgotten from John's talk, do the peaks disperse out when you go to higher energy and reproduce the upper part of that dispersion?
Well, do they spread out?
I see what the labels are.
Yeah. This is up to 200 millivolts up here, which is quite a bit higher than we went, actually. But we went up to about 100, 120 millivolts. Things are smudging out, certainly. They're certainly smudging out up here. So,
is it fair to say it looks like what you've got at lower energies, but not necessarily at higher energies?
No, I think it looks the same, more or less. I mean, if you could call that a resonance, I'm not sure that's as sharp as the real resonance we have, but certainly the 45 degree rotation is the same. The energy scale is slightly different, but in general, the overall pattern, where you have this kind of pattern below the resonance, we have some sort of coming together and the scattering in one point, which is like the resonance, and we have the rotation.
I don't see the rotation. I don't have a mother's eye.
Okay. Well, I think it looks more diamond-like up this way than looks square like that way. Okay. It's with the data, I mean, John wishes the data were better. We all wish the data was better. But you know, I think there is some evidence, at least, for the rotation. To me, this looks certainly rotated from that, but it's the data, you know, signal to noise is not as good as we would like, of course.
But here there's no spin gap, right?
Here there's no spin gap, no. This is a material that's not really superconducting. This is a material that's not really a superconductor, but it's a stripe material.
This is also measured above TC.
Yeah.
This has magnetic long-range order, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, the resonance peak was seen in the Nicola, which is an insulator to begin with.
There's an old measurement that we made I'd like to talk about a little bit. And the measurement involves, is it scattering one-dimensional or two-dimensional in these materials? And myself and our collaborators have somewhat of an argument with, and I think it's all semantics, but a bit of an argument with the German group where Keimer's been involved on whether the scattering is one or two-dimensional. I don't really have any particular weight on which you call it, but I'm going to talk about it in a minute, and maybe you can make up your own mind whether the scattering is best characterized as being one-dimensional or two-dimensional or some combination of the above. But some time ago, quite a long time ago, we finally got a crystal at least was partly detwinned. So certainly the axis here, or certainly if you look at the lattice constant, we had more of that twin in by a factor or two than this. And we went ahead and made some scans above and below the center of the zone here, looking to see what that would do in terms of how the scattering would change along the A and B direction. And so here's the untwinned crystal here, and the scattering certainly looks more or less the same here in both peaks. But the scattering here, which should be smaller, zero here if we had a perfectly untwinned crystal, is smaller here, and should be larger here if we had an untwinned crystal. It should be all of the scattering, certainly is bigger here. And we can figure out for those two patterns that the scattering is certainly mostly bigger along the A star direction. And so we thought this was some evidence, certainly, or rather convincing evidence, in fact, the scattering was larger along one direction than the other, and particularly along the A star direction. And so I felt this, actually, if you've given this amount of twinning, the twinning which we had was about 50%, if you put that 50% twinning in there, that gives you actually within the error bars that you have totally all the scattering along the A star direction. We also measured some phonons, and if you look at the phonons, there's a particular 40 phonon, optical phonon, up around 47 some millivolts, and the scattering along the A direction and B direction should be equivalent here. Those peaks should be the same size and the same height and the same width from one direction to the other direction, and we see they're actually quite different, and they're quite different because the scattering clearly is different in the A star direction than the B star direction, and so that's just one more piece of ammunition that A and B, A star and B star are different, and the scattering can be thought of as being primarily along one direction. Well, then the European group came along with a much better sample, and they pointed out that they had a lot better twinning than we did. Their scattering, their sample is much better than our sample because the twins they have in this sample is much smaller. But their scattering, they said, instead of having two points, as we would say, had this sort of pattern here, which is a ring of scattering, as far as perhaps something like a ring of scattering. We found out, of course, somewhat later in our ISIS measurements, the scattering can't be a ring because it's clearly made up of points. And so I don't think this is quite right. But on the other hand, what do you call this? Is this scattering then one-dimensional or two-dimensional? Well, they claim the scattering is two-dimensional because they have at least some scattering here and there, and I have to agree there's certainly some possibility of that. I thought the scattering was more one-dimensional, so I don't know how you actually characterize that. I'm willing to.
I understand your intensity plot, though. If this were a peak coming up, are you?
If we had 4 points here, then we'd have the 4 pattern that we saw. Remember my plots about the scattering below the resonance? That's just the same as a pattern, the same pattern that I showed below the resonance, but that's their triple axis data. Okay? And instead of the 4 points that I showed, they get 2 points because they have a detwin sample. Okay, but then they get a little bit of scattering in between, so.
I would have thought it would come out on your side, though, somehow. Yeah. If I thought of that as intensity, and I looked where it's red or black, near one, somehow I would see 2 peaks coming up at me, and the rest of the ring.
Yeah, he also talks in nature, right? The emphasis is different.
I think we had aside, it seemed to me that this fits. I'm trying to understand the contradiction between
The contradiction
and what you were saying.
The data, there's no contradiction.
I don't think there's very much contradiction in the data. Here's their data for 6.6. Here, very much like ours, you can see here, this is along B, and this is along A, and their scattering along B is somewhat different than their scattering along A. I think I may have another picture of it here. It's somewhat better. see, here's the scattering along B here, up near the resonance. The data more or less do look the same, and we agree with that. But if you get down below the resonance where we have the incommensurate scattering, certainly their scattering here is smaller along B star than A star, but it's not very much different than our data. Okay, and so whether you think of that scattering as being two-dimensional or one-dimensional, I don't know. But certainly we feel that, you know, there's strong evidence that scattering is number one, not a ring, but instead points. And these points are just somewhat weaker in one direction than the other. And I think of the scattering, unless it's uniform, then it's scattering, you know, is more two-dimensional like than one-dimensional like. But that's a matter of conjecture.
Somebody was mentioning last week that there's an RPA calculation in, including the chain bands in the system.
Yeah.
Does anybody know if that accounts for this?
That's a good question.
It's sort of like a quantitative way, I don't remember. I mean, it's got a pretty substantial anisotropy between A and B.
Yeah, well, I guess that's going to come out. But does it look like that chimer data?
What's that?
Does it look like the chimer intensity plot that we just saw?
I seem to remember that,
The data is very much the same, actually.
One actually has to be careful. I mean, this nice plot with the ring is not raw, not representing raw data.
No, it's a simulation.
This is representing
a simulation.
Oh,
well,
this is not data?
No, that's not data. No, it's a simulation.
This is not data.
Yeah.
An artistic conception.
Of the scattering.
The scattering would look like it. It really
It's
nothing.
It's
just
their simulation.
Okay. All right.
Simulations. What does that mean? Well, they use the intensity part and they coupled it with the resolution.
Oh.
And they did a Monte Carlo calculation, and this is the outcome. Well, not Monte Carlo, I mean some.
No.
Coupled it with the resolution.
Yeah, right.
You just put four Lorentz
and
something else.
Well, okay, one other interesting thing that we saw kind of in the early days is that if you go to this 6.93 and go back to ISIS and look at energy zero, then you see some powder rings here that change that certainly are getting the data and kind of make a mess of parts of it, but you still see these parts here at the bag peaks here now. This is elastic scattering at the bag peaks. And if you look at these a little more carefully, just around one of those bag peaks here, I picked out one to look at, and this is the center zone center here. One finds that this scattering at high temperatures just looks like a blob, but as you cool down, it actually separates out of the kind of a cross here. And if you take the scattering from room temperature minus 10 degrees, you're looking at sort of a full fourfold spots here, with the wave vector being about a quarter. So we have, even from very early days, we have evidence in YBCO, the optimally doped material, there's a 4x4 superlattice, actually. And I think other people now have done X-ray scattering that's probably better than this, that suggests that the chains actually have a lot of responsibility for these four spots, but probably the planes are involved as well. But there are, even you can see in the ISIS data, you can see very clearly that there is a 4x4 superlattice in YBCO that's kind of amusing. Pardon?
This is dynamic, so you're not talking about the static.
This is our measurement of the static.
Elastic?
Elastic, yeah.
What are the rings?
Oh, the ring scattering? One? Yeah, they're powdered peaks.
It's not sure.
A lot of things like.
Why do you get rings around the pi position?
Where? Oh. These are.
Go back.
Okay.
That one.
No, this is.
That's around 0, 0.
Not 0, 0, oh, yeah. Okay. See? Yeah, that's 0, 0 here. Yeah. This is just the whole pattern, you know. This is the center of the zone. Yeah, I'm not worried about magnetic scattering here or anything else.
So YBCO is fourfold modulated and people see it in X-rays, right?
Yeah, sure.
No,
I see it in X-ray. You know they see them in X-ray?
No. I mean, YBCO, you talk about a static 4x4 modulated. No, I see it.
You know they see it?
Sunny, what they saw is underdog stuff, the chain ordering.
Right. Well, this is chain ordering too, I'm sure. Yeah, it could be.
All chain ordering.
I know that Bernard Kimer claims that he sees this scattering identical to what I see by X-rays. Certainly.
Is it consistent with the charge densities? Mm. I mean, the charge, the carrier concentration, the four period four modulation. Like in a striking picture, it's going. You know, people talk about some particle feeling, etc. Mm. Why quarter?
My quarter? I don't know. That's what we get for it. Okay.
So if I change it to 6.9.
Oh, I don't know. We haven't seen this in any other material.
Oh, you haven't seen the 6.9?
We haven't seen it. It's underdope. This is operably dope.
Yeah, that's about fine. 6.95.
Yeah.
I mean, does it respond to doping?
Well, this probably does respond to doping in some way, but I haven't really pursued it.
How can chains give fourfold patterns?
Well, we have a twin crystal.
Oh, it's twin.
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is twin. Okay, well, I'm going to wind this up, actually, probably a little bit ahead of time. Well, the low energy fluctuations, as I said, are dominated by the resonance, of course, as we know, but that should be really a chi of omega or chi of energy is certainly larger for larger than for the incommensurate scattering at low doping. The resonance itself is larger than, well, the chi of ethanum and resonance is larger certainly than the incommensurate scattering, but the high energy excitations have a greater spectral weight, and the energy of these and the intensity of these, when you add over at least some energy region, really have a lot more weight than the resonance and low energy fluctuations. And what I think, and at least that those are, if you're thinking about magnetic pairing, it's possible that these are more likely candidate because those really have a lot more intensity than the resonance or the low energy scattering. The magnetic excitations appear similar over different classes of materials, so we don't know what visco looks like because there are no good crystals of that now, or big enough crystals. But at least it's beginning to look the same over the 1-2-3 materials and the 2-1-4 materials. The excitations are not spin waves, but may be related either to a straight phase, because after all, as I pointed out, John Francois's measurement was on a straight phase material. Well, they could stem from Fermi surface effects, because we have calculations on which the Fermi surface is a basis that give information that looks somewhat similar like our data. So I think there's some room for maybe to improve these calculations, or at least to push them forward in a different direction to interpret them in a better way. There is a large anisotropy, at least a fairly large anisotropy, in the excitations between the A and B directions, and you can call these two-dimensional scattering or one-dimensional scattering. I don't really care, but certainly that last point is certainly true. There is a pretty good anisotropy between the two directions. We see the elastic scattering display this 4x4 lattice. We haven't really pursued that, but assuming that, I mean, other people have measured this and found a similar like thing such as this that stem from the chains, and I assume this probably stems from the chains as well, but really haven't found or pursued this or done any more with it. One have to measure a lot of reflections, probably better by X-rays, to see if we can see if this can be found, first of all, by X-rays, and second of all, found in whether it's found in the chains or the planes or both. So I think that will do it. Thank you.
I just want to say before we start the questions that we have a record here. This is the first speaker to have finished in the allotted time since this workshop.
I don't know whether that's good or bad.
Second.
Second.
That was one.
Oh, was that? Okay. That's I stand right. Correct. Okay.
There's not a lot of money associated with this price anyway.
Okay.
I'm embarrassed for you, Herb.
Yeah, I am too. Don't have very much to say, obviously.
Herb, if I add up the spectral weight that you gave us for the resonance and sub-resonance, and I go above, I realize you haven't gone all the way, but it adds up to what, 0.38? I'm wondering in the units you're using, if it were a Heisenberg, would it add to 1? I'm not sure of your units. You know, SS plus 1 over 3 or whatever. I'm not sure what it should add to.
actually quite smaller than the total weight.
Yeah, the total weight, that's a good point.
For formula unit.
Yeah, for formula unit, is it one or is it some other number?
You remember what I'm saying? Is it SS plus one? I think it says SS.
SS is a half, right?
So SS plus one.
S multiply S plus one.
So 0.75.
3/4.
So, okay, so if it adds to 0.75, then you're getting 0.38, and that's fine, some of it's missing.
Well, a lot of it missing, yeah.
That still may above.
Yeah, right, or just maybe up in the, you know, up in the band somewhere, you know, and you don't know where it is.
Form is perfect, yeah, after all it is.
Yeah, if it's uncorrelated, then we can't see it.
But related finally is, how much weight in the resonance? I know you gave us how much in the resonance and sub-resonance. But if you took the resonance itself, I'm used to hearing numbers like, well, people say, oh, only 3% is in there.
You remember, Pen Cheng, that we had numbers for the resonance back in our papers. I don't remember how much it was.
It's.
Ballpark, 1%, 10%?
Well, it's hard to define resonance, right? The one way to define it is the difference between the normal state and superconducting state. And if you look at the original paper, you had this stretch of weight, this peak, and then a lot of stuff under there. So I mean, the question is, you know, what do you call resonance, right? I mean, especially in the underdoped stuff. In the optimal stuff, it's much less ambiguous, because above.
I wanted to pick optimally, the last, the one we were.
Okay, yes, so Herb actually had a figure on the optimal.
I know he did, but he listened, the resonance plus the spectral weight below the resonance is 0.26.
That's for.
That was for underdoped.
Okay, maybe go back to that, sorry.
Yeah, so I didn't have the resonance itself, but we should have that kicking around.
Yeah, well.
Also, maybe optimal, if it's.
Yeah, because you can show the figure in optimal. That hasn't been published yet.
No, but.
Well, I mean, the data analysis is still ongoing. Keep going.
It's not there, is it?
No, go back. Yeah, that's the figure. If you go down, that's the total spectral weight.
I guess I just can't read it.
It's mu B per mill. I can read it.
Yeah.
Mu B squared per EB.
And I guess.
This is per formula unit.
Rather sloppily plotted up, you know, with a line through it is.
From 20 to 60 with a height of about 2. So we have 20 millivolts, 20 to 60, 40 millivolts.
But that's the total.
Times divided by EV.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you got what? You guys got an integrator, where I.
This way back to integrator.
He's just integrating.
Yeah, so basically.
No, he's just integrating.
Millivolts divided by resonance.
Yeah, that's.
That's a total scattering.
8%, right?
Yeah, it's 8%.
8%, yeah.
That's higher than a lot of people quoted, so I guess curious about. Typically, it's quoted at 3 or 4.
Exactly.
Well, that's not the resonance, that's a total scattering.
Yeah, that's all the secret.
Right, so that's why I'm asking you.
Oh.
I'm curious as to whether you guys give a number for that, because people used to give that number.
Yeah, well, we probably have that number. I don't have it right on my, right now. We could probably get it.
Oh, I see, yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's forgotten, but.
This is optimal.
Oh, this is optimal?
Yeah.
What is it for the 6.6 times per second?
I can't remember, I mean, we have a paper which has essentially the same units, yeah, I can't remember, on the same topic in the science paper, I can't remember the number.
Is that?
Getting way too much weight, no?
Yeah.
What we found is that in the optimal, actually, the magnetic actually drops dramatically as compared. I mean, so our claim is different from Keimer's. Keimer claimed the optimal, underdoped resonance is about the same weight. We think in optimal, the weight is considerably less, because the mass for our optimal sample is a factor of 5 as compared to the underdoped sample.
Well, we had the number for, certainly, 6.6.
Yeah, it's published, I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
Yeah.
But.
I'm sorry, so the weight of the resonance, as you say, is dropped, is less in the optimal?
Yes.
The overall weight that you pick up in, say, 6.6 and 6.93, are they about the same?
No, no.
Or is 6.93 hard because you can't get as, or 6.6 can't get as high as you want?
6.93, this is all the magnetic scattering we can see.
Good, and then 6.6, there's some you can't see.
Yeah, we can't see above, well, we actually have a, I mean, in the science paper we published, we actually won about 180 millimeters, I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, but they never did that in absolute units, so.
No, it wasn't absolute units.
It's also the case in aluminum astronomy, the overall magnetic weight goes down with increasing, when you go to the overdose regime, it goes away completely.
You can actually compare this plot to the science paper we published, which has the absolute units as well.
Okay, but that's quite, yeah, okay.
I'd like to comment on the early work of ours, and connection to this one. Namely, at some point, it was Batista, myself, and Artis, we published a paper where we argued for common magnetic origin of the resonance peak and then commensuration. And the story was that the resonance peak is nothing but commensurate response of inherently incommensurate antiferromagnet. And the story is that if you take a simple, just consider the spin wave approximation, no carriers whatsoever, you just do the antiferromagnet and slice it with a particular periodicity structure, you have the folding of the spin wave spectrum and getting these incommensurate peaks. So,
you start
with the antiferromagnet, and then you do some kind of like, in the period delta and momentum space, so you have omega versus q, which is a true longer and shorter, but of course because of this modulation it starts beating, and so we have this. So you essentially, what you should imagine, the two incommensurate spin wave spectra emanating from the, basically the place which is displaced from the pi pi by incommensuration delta. And then we decided to be quite stupid about it,
really
thinking it's spin wave distortion and should we see where we land up.
Is there a light next to the board?
The lights are over there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a light here, maybe.
That's a little hurt to get out. Okay.
Yeah.
So look, we start from incommensurate wave vectors. We're shooting up, we essentially spin wave distortion, we're hitting a certain point. There's a level crossing, so if nothing else, there is a one-fold singularity there that brings a lot of spectral weight to this.
Yeah, but where's the rest of the branch? We're looking at the whole zone in these pictures.
I'm sorry?
We're looking at the whole zone in these pictures. How about the other part of the branch?
But what about the doping dependence of the intersection?
Yeah, it will basically look, the doping dependence delta, if it with the doping delta grows with x, so your resonance energy will grow with x.
Yeah, but you don't see this part, you know.
Yeah, and in the any of the fear analysis, I'm telling you will see only some. Well, the way to do it is that you have to suppress the outer branches. So,
yeah.
Whether you start with the striped pictures or whether you start with the RPA, you will be dealing with the same issue, actually, what the outer branches are doing. These outer branches also happen to be suppressed in chromium as well. And nobody's making a big deal about the esoteric nature of the spin waves in the chromium. Chromium is incommensurate, spin waves today. So my point is that actually you can essentially very well doping, especially when you sort of can rely on the linear approximation, you can relay the energy or the resonance peak to the doping and to incommensuration. And it's closely connected to your model plot, which seems to work at 0.1 and what we see all times.
Is that seen in an experiment?
Yes. What is seen in the experiment is the following. Let me tell you the two predictions. One is actually taking nickelite.
Nickelite, people see the other branch.
Yes. The nickelite, if you take these numbers and all that you shoot up, we predicted about, 70 millivolts, they found it at 80. And this was done before experiment on nickelite was done. I'm just saying that a very simple commensurate bright spot due to incommensuration in the magnetic response accounts for a lot of features here. At the same paper in 2001, we predicted that if I take the same sort of analysis for the 214, I'll get the resonance energy of about, I think it was 45 mm. You always have to be careful because you basically, depending on the uncertainty of the dispersion and velocity, basically you can shoot above or below the energy. And we were desperately trying to find out any basic statement about the existence of the resonance in 214, and people said, no, we never seen anything, etc.
I showed you a picture of it.
Well, you didn't know about this work, and you didn't know about the prediction. Your problem actually with, like you and Ping Sheng and others get hung up is actually what happened to this other brush.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying that the same issue is actually in the chromium, and it's true in nickelite, you see much better the other branches. But there is also like overall, if there is overall so like structure factors that boosts intensity around pi, I see no problem with suppressing intensity of outer branches. But they should be there in this picture. So if you want, this is another litmus test. But I would say that before any experiment was done, there were two predictions that seemed to be like both of them coming out.
What would it be probably for the rotation by 45?
Yeah, rotation actually we cannot address. We never looked at the rotation. And I guess
we know the answer. Well, we have to guess.
No, I don't have a simple question. But I think actually what I do, I'm assuming very simple. So like, remember there's there is no inner structure to magnetic response within this thing. So if I hit it with energy high enough, maybe that's basically what will happen, that there is additional magnetic degree of freedom leaving here that basically would allow me some rotation.
I would rather melt it, mess it up, but not necessarily work it.
Yeah, so for instance, Matthias, actually, he had this idea of the so like more complicated, so chop it up with a more complicated external structure, so like excitations.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, in your case, then, I mean,
since Sasha is just commenting on this, I should probably continue. I mean, we did a detailed calculation based on a stripe picture, but assuming not just a classical antichromatic order in the stripes, but rather coupled spin ladders, which add some quantum effects. And then you see that the high energy part of the spectrum is dominated by quantum effects, essentially from the spectrum of a spin ladder. If you do this calculation, so you do take coupled spin ladders and simply honestly calculate everything, I mean in a spin-only model, then you first find the rotation as in an experiment. And second, if you take all the form factors, matrix elements into account, you also see that the outer branches are suppressed, that they are there, but the intensity is much suppressed.
I see.
And at the end, we get something which very much resembles what Jean-Francois I see.
And what is the interpretation and for that rotation, it's just rather peculiar.
The high energy physics, essentially dominate by ladders, and therefore you get your scattering intensity is lying along lines which in theory is Brillouin zone or this and this.
Yes.
And the low energy intensity is dominated by the Bragg spots which sit here and here.
I see. Okay.
And exactly.
Oh, that's nice.
The intersections of these lines simply define the four points of this square which is rotated compared to this low energy square.
Okay.
Can I explain the rotation for the optical mode?
Yeah, that's my question.
I'm just thinking about it. We did only the calculation for a single layer material. You can easily extend this to a two layer material. We did not do this, and I'm not sure whether it will come out, but it's something which I should have to think of.
There was no data.
I have this data today for the first time, so
we didn't look at the bilayers either, so. I think actually, I presume it would be because we're dealing with essentially inherently sound modes, you can do optical mode and actually you can get this sound mode. So I think actually, probably you can get some kind of like optical like response in terms of suppressing substantially the nearly growth of the modes. The low energy part is just probably easy. Just
but in your case, you essentially just two spin waves in the merging. But the question is, do you expect four distinct spots or sort of a circle below?
No, there's actually four spots, or two spots in this case.
Because
if you would do the fully like...
Just two spin waves, right? Two cones coming out, right, essentially. Two cones coming out and meet at some point, right?
That's what is below the energy, right. Below the resonance.
Would you expect, a distinct diamond shape or...
And then actually I need to do some kind of like some rotation. Philip Ronald, somebody who is working with Game Rapid, he said he took our model and just assigned it a little bit of the weight to rotate, and actually he can have it like squarish like with a spread out intensity. And he was doing like what you call in the model. He was just taking these four peaks and taking like you put a cream cheese, it's spread out intensity by doing certain so like probabilities and configurations.
Would there be any smoking gun by which one could discriminate between the, at least to my mind, completely different points of views, having either Fermi surface effects and RPA and resonances occurring by bound states, and the spin ladder point of view? I mean, would there be anything that, I mean, there are these two ideas around since quite some time now, and I would just like to have anything that tells, would, for example, the weight and the resonance be something? Like, would the schematic picture give, I guess that would get a pretty large weight to this frame AV type of feature.
Well,
okay, would there be anything to this domain?
We have to keep in mind that, let's say, the YPCO definitely doesn't have static stripes.
Not.
So the calculations we did are, of course, based on static stripes, but you could imagine if the stripes are slowly fluctuating, then at least this will change something at the lowest energies because there is no order, but at higher energies it will look similar. But now, in principle, at least in theorist's mind, you can continuously connect this picture of fluctuating stripes, which is a strong coupling limit of something, to, let's say, the weak coupling situation where any type of ordering comes from the Fermi source. There is no phase transition in between.
Right.
So therefore, I think there is no smoking gun to distinguish the two if there is no symmetry breaking anywhere. So in principle, a sophisticated weak coupling approach coming from high doping could meet with a sophisticated strong coupling approach. And so, of course, the intensity distributions will be different, but this is due to the approximations. And there was no symmetry breaking in between, no transition, then I guess it's really hard to discriminate.
I wouldn't disagree with this.
I would completely agree with you that there is no phase transition in between, and we should somehow be able to continuously go from one side to the other. But the resonance from the RPA point of view, to my mind, is still something very different. It's a bound state. It's somehow.
Well, I'm not so sure.
Would you make some?
I mean, the bound state of the RPA we would call a collective mode, and in this spin-only picture we throw away all the rest and only model the collective mode.
It's not really a bound state. You just have this one dimension dispersion.
There is a much simpler answer to this, if I can tell you, which is actually like I don't know. On this one, I happen to be with him. We have some points of disagreement, but. But perhaps you didn't register. This thing has been observed in the insulator. The resonance peak and the commensurate peaks merging together and producing a resonance peak. So the whole idea of the resonance peak connected to superconductivity and important in the metal or conductive substances, I don't think is important. You can see this plenty of this incommensurate peaks merging and producing resonance like phenomena in insulators. Nickelite is the one example. Which is actually the charge insulator. There is no matter what the doping is, you never get resist, you know, never get a metallic. You still have this resonance peak scene.
Could I continue on that and say yes. If that is true, what you say, then the mode that we're looking at, or that may be something that is not related to PC, is essentially just the zone boundary triplet excitation of a spin ladder.
Yes.
That's what it has
very little to do, if anything, with superconductivity. It's certainly not blue.
What? That I
didn't say.
But the RPA calculations, it's crucial that it's a D-wave supernova, right?
The idea is actually the resonance peaks in the insulator. We apply to this. All what you're seeing is a conventional response of inconventional dynamic ferromagnet.
No, but I mean, it has a very strong feeling effect, like the resonance. You suppress superconductivity, you suppress that. I mean, and also, you can see this clear change.
You don't suppress it.
It can't be a spin wave, because a spin wave would not change in the field. Resonance does.
But we've done the experiments showing
the story is actually, of course, just like his modeling. If you look at these, only is like magnetic response with no carriers. I don't know what carriers are doing in magnetic field. Obviously, there is a coupling, and through this coupling, the carrier spectrum will affect the spectrum of magnetic excitation.
No, a spin wave, magnetic field won't do anything to a spin wave like that.
Could a good smoking gun to distinguish these two scenarios be the quantity that Herb showed us, this magnetization within the resonance peak versus what was outside?
You mean spectral weight?
Yeah, the spectral weight within the resonance versus outside. And I would think the spin ladder and the other, so maybe we can break the result.
Yeah, that was actually was my question. What do you expect from a simple spin ladder or spin, you know, or whatever slack type of model as a function of doping, that how the resonance, I mean, how this merging as a function of doping should change, and how the spectral waves should change? You know, give us, from a theoretical point of view, you know, a prediction that one can check. I mean, what is data to check? Right?
What you want is the ratio of the spectral wave and the resonance compared to what is
right. As a function of doping.
Okay, so we didn't do this calculation. I mean, what in the simple calculation, what we have to put in, I mean, the RPA has to put in the Fermi surface, we have to put in the incommensuration by hand, I mean, the value of the incommensuration, then we can calculate the spectrum, then we could answer this, but we haven't done it.
So basically, if you have the answer is a 4, if you have a resonance peak intensity, so this is actually all done for the no carriers. Now, you put the carriers, of course, these things are gone first, because of white-time effects and coupling in the carriers. And what you see is something like this. And then you can start monitoring the intensity at the peak here versus how much is left over from the Goldstone modes here. There are two limits. Spin gap is much less than the resonance energy, and spin gap is comparable to resonance energy. If the spin gap is much less than the resonance energy, these peaks are coming way down, then you're getting much more intensity here than getting here. In case two, when the spin gap is a four of the outer resonance, you start getting the comparable intensities. And so we always thought that this is the reason why in VCO you see it much more. Basically because this mode can easily decay into two excitations living here. That's why you're getting a lot of spectral wave. And Dini, is this kind of...
Sorry, no, I didn't listen. Sorry, I wasn't in my own world. Sorry, I'll talk to you later.
All right. Okay, so basically the intensity of the resonance peak versus intensity of the incommensurate peaks, the answer to your question depends on the energies.
Oh.
Okay. I think the part of what we're talking about is if you think you're going to be in the metallic state, then the carriers become, it seems to me, very important, and how they couple to this mode depends on coherence factors as to whether they want to go superconducted. It's a D wave or an S wave. And you get, I think, different results, and I think you get different spectral weights and different effects just due to the fact that when it goes superconductive, you push, because of the D wave gap, the way it opens, you push spectral weight up out of the way and can make visible a resonance that otherwise is severely damped. And so, in that sense, I think we ought to be able, at the end of the day, to understand whether a spin ladder is fruitful way to handle the whole temperature dependence, or whether maybe it's just a very good way to handle the lower temperature or other aspects of it, because I would think the damping might be very different in the two models.
Two comments. One is, even though I'm repeating myself compared to what I said last week, there seems to be a conception that within these RPA type approaches, the resonance mode has anything to do with the view of the pairing. Within that picture, this is just not correct. The resonance mode is not even there at TC, so the entire pairing within that picture, never mind whether it's true or wrong, but just in that picture, at TC is not determined by the resonance mode. It has just nothing to do with the pairing mode. So that's just consistent with what you say, and it's also, and using this as a counterexample is just not fair.
What is giving the glue within the RPA?
All the incoherent background. That's what gives you the TC. At TC, you don't even have a gap within that picture. If never mind pseudo gap and phase fluctuating, whatever you want to put on top of this. But in the straightforward mean field recoupling picture, at TC, there's no gap. Yet there's no resonance mode. Yeah. At very low temperatures, of course, you get all these physics, you get a resonance mode, it appears, it has impact, it feeds back, all that stuff can happen, but it has nothing to do in what determines the value of TC. But the question I had was actually the field dependence of the resonance mode. I felt it said it was a spin one type excitation, whereas a spin wave should actually look differently. Can we just quickly summarize how it looks like?
Well, a spin wave
you know, the goat that's 41 millivolts high, okay, has a magnetic field will not change it at all, of course. You know, it's not going to change J.
Okay.
You know, a magnetic field doesn't change J at all.
Was there any splitting within the field?
Not observable.
Okay. We looked for it, but we couldn't find, didn't see any splitting itself.
Okay.
But intensity went down.
Intensity changes a lot.
Okay, yeah.
So that's presumably, the intensity changing a lot, I would think, could be that you're changing the quasi particles that are busy damping the thing, at least within the RPA. Now, it's not to say they couldn't dampen the ladder, but if they aren't put into the ladder, pardon me, the ladder calculations just have skins, then they don't have that ingredient in them, not that they couldn't.
One thing I'd like, although I'm drawing the picture here at the spin wave, actually, we did a calculation for TJ model, one-dimensional case, where you can go to pretty long systems. So it was not in no way reliant upon basically some Goldstone-like approximation to money. You looked at the carriers and you do the calculation for the basically one such for one-dimensional TJ. You get exactly the same picture I'm telling you.
It's a very nice picture.
When I call the spin wave, I'm just saying that you're capturing a lot of truth about it by doing very simple cartoonish picture, but you can be more sophisticated. Now about the what you said, that it's a misconception. I think it's revisionism, because basically there is a literature out there about SO5, where basically the connection between the superconductivity and the resonance peak was pointed 1-to-1, etc. In other words, I know what Chubukov and you and Gilmore and others are doing. So this is one aspect. But the initial sort of wave on SO5 and the resonance peak was exactly this very simple, very nice, sweet story that actually right below TC peak rises up. And I agree with you that actually that's what we were driving at. This is not true. Maybe it's oversimplification when you talk about your spin wave. I mean, your paramagnet on the chain. But I think actually it's also not
that was right.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just saying that actually
I got you.
Statements very clear, statements were made before.
That's but in your model there should be some quantitative relationship between how these four, you know, spin wave like things merge together. Should be at most a factor four intense, right? As a resonant condition, right? Because
no, not necessarily
it comes from four spot. I mean it just four places coming
out. In TJ model you see the largest intensity right down there. If you look at the one-dimensional TJ model, you have a lot of intensity at incommensurate places.
So this is where itinerance in fact comes in.
We looked at the exact solvable, diagonal like one-dimensional TJ model. The carriers were there. So to dismiss this saying that this is a spin wave, just approximation, that's not true.
But if you have carriers there, then the spin wave stiffness would also depend on that one, right? And so the simple picture of just having the two columns shifting by delta must be right, because we will also have a change of slope.
Yes.
Right?
But this is a very small change of slope. You know, like we're talking about 10% doping.
10%
bare J.
Okay, we seem to be moving into details a bit, and I see that some people would like to maybe go and sit on the patio by the looks on their faces. So let's thank the speakers again. Continue the discussion without any constraints of the rest of the audience.